Dark Wraith Publishing presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, academic classroom lectures in business and economics recorded for podcast. This is Business Finance, FIL 240, Section 4 for Spring Semester 2010. Lecture 7, delivered on February 4, 2010. The title of this lecture is Ratio Analysis of Financial Statements.
Today, Ratio Analysis of Financial Statements. I caution strongly that we are going to be dealing with accounting data, accounting information. And the first problem is that accounting information does not include all of the costs that face the firm. What is in numbers hides, most importantly, opportunity costs. And also, as important perhaps, is that accounting data is historical data, and therefore it has a deep bias toward the past, not toward the future. However, we are looking through a window darkly. We can glean some information from financial statements, but this isn't all about numbers. In finance, we get the numbers cranked out, and we can do that with an Excel spreadsheet, and I'll try to put online for the weekend an interactive spreadsheet where you can take financial statements, play with the numbers, and see what happens to ratios as you play with the numbers. We can do that very easily with mechanical devices. Where we come to the fore is in the analysis. What does this mean? Why did we find the numbers we did? Why did the numbers change the way they did? We can look behind the screen of the numbers and say, okay, why did the inventory turnover ratio rise? Why did return on assets fall? What were the reasons? We can even dig sometimes down to the level of management. We can look at what we call, okay, here's how it goes. In this, what we're doing today, what we'll do today, is called technical analysis. Technical analysis. In finance, sometimes we'd call the technical analysts the elves, L-V-E-S. They're the elves. They're the ones who crunch numbers in finance. And then, however, behind the elves is what we call fundamental analysis, where we go beyond the numbers. We use the numbers and use those as a guide for asking probative questions about management, about the market, about the economy and its relationship to the firm. So the fundamental analysis comes after the technical analysis. As we say in my version, where I am a fundamental analyst, the mages come when the elves have finished their work. And what I'm going to do here today is show you how the elves do their work. And then on Tuesday, we go and we level up to where the mages work. So we begin this with just the fundamentals of a financial statement. Now, you recall that an income statement begins with revenue minus cost of goods sold to get you your gross. And then you take your... From there, well, as a matter of fact, I'd probably better write this on the board. I'm sure most of you have committed this to heart in accounting and other classes, but let me write this. From the income statement, we have our revenues less cost of goods sold, and that drives us down to the gross profit. And so from the gross profit, we take our depreciation expense, and then we take away our selling and administrative expenses, and we get ourselves to EBIT, which we would otherwise call our operating income. And then from EBIT, we will take out the interest, which gets us to EBT. And from there, we'll take out our taxes, and that drives us down to our net income. Now, net income, you're going to hear me switch a little bit and sometimes use another term for this. You're going to hear me use the term earnings. Now, at this point, I would want to look at the balance sheet of the firm and see how many shares of common stock are outstanding. And if I take the earnings divided by the number of shares outstanding, number of shares of common stock outstanding, I will get what is called earnings per share, EPS, which is useful. EPS. Now, there's another one out there, too. Some firms, the number of shares outstanding isn't the whole story, because there are oftentimes executives, other insiders, maybe some outsiders, too, who have shares that they could get if they wanted to, if the price of the stock went up. Okay, let me try this. You could have, as an executive, the right to buy the stock at $5 a share. Now, you say a million shares. Now, if the stock is $3 a share, you wouldn't exercise that right, but you have that right. Now, if the stock goes to $8 a share, you'll exercise, and you'll take that. Those are what, that is basically what is called a warrant. A warrant. Now, we sometimes are interested in saying, instead of dividing by the number of shares outstanding, let's look at how many total shares could be out there if everyone exercised his or her warrants, options on stock. We call that the fully diluted EPS, the fully diluted earnings per share. It's something that you want to keep in mind, because a lot of times, how many shares are outstanding is not, the number of shares that could be outstanding is actually fairly large compared to the number of shares that are outstanding. So I will point out, I won't write it here, but fully diluted earnings per share, you'll see that term sometimes. What that means is, instead of dividing by the number of shares outstanding in the denominator, you take how many shares could be outstanding if every hoe handle who has stock could exercise a warrant. To give you an idea, a little bit more background, when I was doing consulting and brokering, penny stock brokering, oftentimes we try to sell stock, and honestly, these companies were just small, highly risky, and all of that. So if I tried to sell just a share of common stock of one of these companies, I mean, it was like, I wasn't going to get anyone to buy. Well, I might get the guy's grandma to buy some and all that, which is literally what we did sometimes. We were so desperate we hit up the family members. But what I did more as time went on is I would create what are called unit offerings. Instead of offering to sell, say, a share of stock at $5 a share, I would sell a unit, which included one share of stock plus, in one case, two warrants exercisable at $8.50 a share. No, I'm sorry. One of the warrants was exercisable at $7, and the other one was exercisable at $8.50. So you see, it was like a sweetener in the offering. But then, of course, there were all those shares out there that were not outstanding. But if the stock price went up, suddenly you'd have a lot more stock in this company outstanding. So that's one of the reasons you'll see that fully diluted be meaningful, is if companies have been attaching warrants onto stock in offerings to sweeten the pot, which I did probably four or five times by the end. And typically, we would just say, you buy a share of stock for $5 in this offering, and you get a warrant, a couple of warrants. One you can exercise at $7, and the other at $8.50, or something like that. And so that's why sometimes the number of shares of common stock outstanding isn't the whole story of how much stock is out there waiting to hit the company. Now, then we'll do dividends. And here, and that will be, this last line would be your contribution to retained earnings. Now, this is how I do it, and there are other ways to do it. This is my way. One thing also here is the total dividend is sometimes useful to us, but sometimes we would want to take that total amount of dividend paid and divide it by the number of shares outstanding. And again, this will tell us the dividends per share, DPS. That will be the dividends per share. And again, you can do fully diluted dividends per share, but normally you wouldn't do that. You wouldn't do that, really. With EPS, you will see fully diluted EPS, but I don't think I don't see hardly ever fully diluted dividends per share. Usually we just take dividends, divide the total amount of dividend paid divided by the number of shares outstanding to get the dividends per share on the company. And that's my terminology, and there are some who would say, well, you say should say earnings is what we have after the dividends are paid, whatever. Okay. Now, that's the income statement. Now the balance sheet. Now on the balance sheet, and we're going to make this woefully simple, on the asset side, we'll have the current assets. Now for our purposes in this class, some of these will be more important than others. First you have your cash. And sometimes you see this as one line, cash and marketable securities. Sometimes you see it as two lines. I'm going to write it here as one line just to save myself some space, cash and marketable securities. Next up comes your accounts receivable. And then after that, I'm going to put it in, prepaid expenses. Like if you pay a whole year's insurance premiums in one shot, and then you would put that all, and then you would expense out to the on a monthly basis the amount of the total premium per month. It's not significant usually. But now then you got the big kahuna inventory. What the hell am I missing here? I think that's it. And so that's your total current assets. Now, then for your long-term assets, I'm going to be really simple about this. You can get a somewhat more complicated. Gross fixed assets less accumulated depreciation, and that brings you to your net fixed assets. And then you might have other kinds of long-term assets in there, like goodwill, intangible assets, things like other kinds of intangible assets. Those can go in there too. I'm going to try to avoid too much on that in any problem. Goodwill, other intangibles. And sometimes these intangibles have their own amortizations, so you'd have gross minus accumulated amortization brings you down to your final net intangibles. But one way or the other, you take net fixed assets plus goodwill plus other intangible assets, however, whatever else you've got in that arcane system, and you will have your total long-term assets, and then you add up total long-term assets and your current assets and your long-term assets, and you get your total assets. And again, I appreciate that almost all of you have seen this before. You've committed it to memory. Indeed, some of you have probably had this, gotten tattoos with this on you. You probably have bought posters so that you can put them up in your room. Or not, maybe. Okay. And then on the other side, we have your liabilities, which comprise current liabilities, and in the current liabilities, probably the biggest one of all is your accounts payable, and then from there it kind of degenerates. In current liabilities, you might see notes payable, short-term paper, something like that, due in less than a year, that kind of stuff. But really, in accounts payable is one of your biggies. And in finance, you know, I can break it down into other ones. But I'll put in here that you might see notes payable in here. Okay, you might see notes payable. And you might see some other things, but I'm not going to push it too far. But I caution, a little later today, I'm going to say debt. When I say debt, make sure you don't just look at long-term debt. Look up and see if there's some short-term debt floating in there too, okay? Sometimes that'll happen. But one way or the other, total current liabilities. And then you'll have your long-term liabilities. And the only thing that we really worry about in long-term liabilities is your long-term debt. What we sometimes just call debt. And then that's your total long-term liabilities. But I caution again, there are other things in there. And then you add those two together and you get your total liabilities, your current liabilities plus your long-term liabilities, your total liabilities. And then you get your owner's equity section. And I'll have to put that over here because I'm running out of boardroom. And in the owner's equity section, you'll have common stock. Okay. Common stock at par plus additional paid in capital. And then you'll have your little statement of retained earnings, January 1, plus net income, less dividends, brings you down to your retained earnings at the end, say on December 31. You add that number plus those two, and you will get your total owner's equity, total shareholder's equity, I should call it in this class, total shareholder's equity. And you add that with your total liabilities, and that should equal your total assets. And I'm finally through that. I dread doing that every semester, but there it is. There you have a simplified version of what you learned in accounting. I hope I included everything that was significant in there. Okay, now we can do some stuff. Ratios, financial ratios, are merely numbers that we calculate by dividing one of these things in a financial statement by another. And there is some reason why we will do it in specific circumstances. Now, who the hell put all these chairs up here? What'd they have, some kind of a convention? Okay, finally. Now we divide the ratios into different categories. The first one are the profitability ratios. The profitability ratios. Those are the ones that give us percentages. And by the way, rock solid rule in this class is that if it's going to be a percentage, you calculate it to two decimal places as a percentage. In other words, as a decimal, you round it to four decimal places, and then you times it by 100 to turn it into a percentage. Many ratios are percentages. Not all of them are. Some of them are actually factors. In other words, they're multipliers. So if it's a percentage, give me a percent. If it is a factor, you put a little X on it afterwards to say times, to show me that you know that it's a factor. I will actually take a little tiny bit off on an exam if you don't give me the right way to present a number, and if you don't give me the right number of decimal places. Why? Because I'm a bitch. Other than that, though, when you go out there and you do this in a real-world place, in a business, if you ever have to, if you present it in the standard form, no one notices. If you present it in a non-standard form, everyone, the important people who matter, are going to snicker. So it's one of those what we call negative exclusions. When you don't do it, everyone notices. If you do it, no one is going to be the wiser for the fact that you don't know that much about the subject. You know how to write the ratios. Look, first one, gross margin. You take your gross over your sales. Gross margin. These are, again, these are the profitabilities. Profitability ratio. Ratios. The first one is your gross margin. And that is your gross income over your sales. It tells you how much, what percentage of your sales you get to keep after you've paid your direct bills for getting those sales. Typically, it can be all over the place. To be honest with you, it can be all over the place, depending on the industry. Some industries have gross margins that are 85, 90%. Other industries, the gross margin is actually pretty low, in the 40, 45% range maybe, 30%. It just depends upon the industry. You can't say anything without looking at industry standards, industry comps. Now, operating margin, the operating margin is, not surprisingly, EBIT over sales. That tells you what percentage of your revenues survived all of your expenses up to your business all of your business expenses. It's a good one to tell you, all right, after paying for the production of what we sold, after paying all the other costs associated with what we sold that we couldn't exactly directly apply, this is what's left. And again, it's all over the board. I've seen these margins in some industries. Your operating margin is up in the 50, 60% range. Others, the operating margin is pretty thin, in the 25, 30%. I've seen them all over the place. And then finally, your nice net margin. That's the bottom line margin, and that is, of course, net income over sales. It tells you how much of your revenue from selling your stuff survived to the bottom line. That's what it does. It's just that simple. And again, you can see net margins 7%, 12%, 20%. You can also see net margins of healthy companies below 1%. It's a pretty surprising thing. Years ago, during one of those major upstrokes in the price of oil, and if I recall right, this was in the 1970s, after oil and gasoline, oil prices had gone through the roof because of the OPEC oil embargo, gasoline prices skyrocketed, and they never came back down to earth after that. And the oil companies were doing PR commercials on TV, mainly to try to keep Congress from doing some radical things like punishing them with windfall taxes. But this executive of one of the oil companies, I think it was one of the executives, he was on this commercial, and he held up a penny. And he said, did you know that our net income on every dollar of gasoline we sell is less than one penny? Of course, everyone said, oh, bullshit. He was right. The net margin, he was telling the truth. It was less than 1%. One penny for every dollar gallons dollar of sales, the oil company had a net margin of below a penny. And a lot of people didn't believe it. They thought he was lying. He wasn't. But they're still hugely profitable companies. Why? Because they sell billions and billions of dollars worth of gasoline and other products, and other hydrocarbon products. So you can have very low net margin, but as long as you're selling lots and lots, as long as your sales are way up in the stratosphere, you can do very well. Now, there are a couple of other ones here. There are two others. I'm trying to think. I'll say this in a minute. I better do this before I get too far. Return on assets. That's net income over total assets. ROA. Now, what this does is essentially tell you what your total asset base is. Excuse me. Oh, that was bad there. Oh, Denny's breakfast tasted better this morning. Let's try that again. What that tells you is essentially what your total assets yielded. The yield you got on your total assets. Like if you got $10 million in total assets and your net income for the year was $1 million, then at the bottom line, your total assets and yielded you 10%. And then, of course, you'd ask, well, could I have made more, a better yield doing something else with that money than $10 million? Or was that a great use of $10 million based upon the risk that I took with the $10 million in having those total assets spent on that $10 million? It's essentially like a yield kind of thing. You buy a car for, okay, in your case, $200. $200. And you're going to make money on that car. So your first year you decide that you're going to deliver. What would you deliver? I know what you deliver. Love. Hugs on wheels. Yes. And so he drives around giving people hugs. Okay. So in his first year, he makes in hugs on wheels $10. Times are good. You make more the next year because then you get the Elvis outfit. Okay, to go. So he spent $200 for the car. His total assets are $200. He makes $10. So he got a return on his investment of 5%. That's what we're doing there. It's actually kind of a simple, sometimes it sounds like I'm using really fancy terminology, but the concepts behind it are actually pretty simple. ROA is one of those very cool things. It's a very simple number, but it kind of cuts through the bull and says, what was your yield on this, on what you did here? And then your ROE, your return on equity. Return on equity. And that would say, Oh, that would be calculated as net income over shareholders' equity. And in a sense, what this does is says, never mind how much we earned on all of our investment, how much did we earn on the owner's money? And that's one that the owners probably care a whole hell of a lot about. We gave you all this money. Of that $10 million, $8 million of it was from us. The other $2 million was you borrowed. So if you earn $1 million and that was $8 million that we kicked into the kitty, how much did you earn on what we kicked in? And in that case, it'd be 1 over 8 or 12.5%. So you see, this one tells what the owners might care about, not just total how much you earned on all of the value of the corporation and assets, but on the part of that value that was contributed by the shareholders or is claimed by the shareholders, I should say. So that's ROE. And I'm going to have to get all this stuff off the board here now. I kind of wanted to keep it, but I'm running out of white space here. So I'm going to get this center line off here, and I'm going to write some more ratios. Now, before I go on, there are a couple of ratios that I'm going to show you that are not used in the book. They're old style ratios, and I'll give you the old style term for them. Sometimes, even with these ratios that are in the book, you'll hear me use the old terminology we used to use when the field was more macho than it is now. Like, instead of calling it the quick ratio, we call it the acid test. And then you're going to hear me use one that's not even in the book. It's called the burn ratio. And I'll say, what's the burn when I have you do these? And you got to know because it's not in the book. And also, there are a couple that are in the book. And quite honestly, I don't use them. I don't know. So the financial analysts that I've always worked with, they don't really use them. So I'm not going to even bring them up. If I don't bring it up, I'm not holding you to it. But if I do bring it up, even if it isn't in the book, yeah, that one you're going to get. Now, the next set of ratios are liquidity ratios. These are liquidities. Liquidity ratios. And here's where I get the current ratio. The current ratio is your current assets over your current liabilities. It simply tells you the balance between what you have that is liquid and what you owe that is due in the near future. Ideally, in a perfect world, the current ratio would be floating in the range around 1. You remember that matching principle? You should probably have your maturity should match and all that. That's in the real world. It ain't going to work like that. Your current ratio can be higher than 1, quite a bit higher. It can be lower than 1. At the end of the course, one of the last topics I cover is what's called working capital management policy. In some companies, they deliberately tilt toward big fat-ass current assets compared to the current liabilities. And in other companies, they tilt away from that. You have to look at the industry standards. Again, it's always comps, but also appreciate that you have to look at do the fundamental analysis. Well, this current ratio is like 2.2. That's awfully high. Let's look at the industry. The industry is at 1.7. So that worries me. This company's current ratio is quite high. Then I have to look, do I read anything in the financial statements, in the notes to the financials or in the MD&A, the management discussion and analysis, in the Securities Exchange Commission filings? Is there anything that explains it? And then I begin to think about the psychology of the management. Is this really a perversity, or is this management pursuing some kind of an idea? And also I have to look over a long period of time, has this company been a leader in the industry moving ratios? So maybe this company has over historically been the one that started using ratios that were different from the industry, but then later the whole industry began to move in that direction. So you have to look, it's not just saying, well, that's too high or that's too low. That's incredibly too simple. You have to look at a lot of deep things that are the heart of true fundamental analysis in financial management and investment analysis. Okay, the next one is the quick ratio. Essentially, now, these guys over here were all percentages. In the profitability ratios, those will always come out to be percentages. Again, you calculate them, round them to 4 decimals, and then times by 100 to get a 2 decimal place percentage. Always. Okay, you do that. Now, these cats over here are multipliers. Like if my current assets are $1.5 million and my current liabilities are $1 million, then that current ratio comes out to be 1.5 times. Because, in other words, my current assets are covering my current liabilities 1.5 times over. Now, the current ratio tells me if I had to pay all of my current bills, how many times over could I do it with my current liabilities? That's what the current ratio tells us. How many times over, if I had to, could I cover my current liabilities with my current assets? But, realistically, not all of your current assets have the same liquidity. Inventory sucks at liquidity. If you were desperate for money to pay off all your current liabilities, your inventory is not going to sell for more than a dime on the dollar, really. The quick ratio takes the current assets and subtracts out inventory. And then divides by the current liabilities. Again, it's a multiplier. How many times over could I cover my current liabilities with my current assets, given that I won't get anything from my inventory? Again, how many times over would I be able to pay my current liabilities with my current assets, given that I'm going to assume that I can't get anything from anything significant for my inventory? This one, you will hear me use the old term called the acid test. The quick ratio, you'll hear me use the term acid test. Sometimes you'll just hear me say, what's acid? Okay? Like I said, back in the old days, we had a little bit more macho terminology. Okay? Now, the last one is not in the book. This is the one that I'm actually quite interested in as a financial analyst. If everything went to hell, apocalypse is right there on us. The whole world has turned into zombies, except for us in this class. The door was closed, so we didn't get the zombie virus. What the hell? I just got the Blu-ray of Zombieland, so watch it again. Relive the dream. Where the hell was it? Okay. If everything went to hell and I just had to cover my current liabilities today, by the end of the day, if I don't cover my current liabilities, the door opens, the zombies come in and eat my flesh. And I don't want that. So what kind of a test would do that? Well, my cash and marketable securities on the numerator. So one last one is just my cash and marketable securities divided by my current liabilities. This is actually the most realistic of them. If your ass had to pay your bills today, all you got is what's in your wallet and what's in the bank deposit. So we called, in the old days, it didn't have a fancy name, we just called it the burn test. We called it burn. So if I ask you what's burn, you just do cash and marketable securities divided by. And what's important is if you do all three of these ratios for a company, look at the pattern of how they fall. Is it a smooth fall? Is it a dramatic fall? Is it a clumpy? Do two of them stick together and one of them kind of hang off the other two? That's the kind of thing that is more deeper financial analysis. Even at the technical level, that's deeper technical. Only the Keebler elves, shall we say, do that. But when you look at all three of them, sort of looking at the relative drop in them, obviously they will fall. You see how these ratios in order will fall as you calculate them for a given company. But the question is, how rapid is the fall, and is there a clumpiness in the fall? And we'll talk about that the next time we're together. But those are the biggies on the liquidity. Those are biggies. Now I'm going to do the debt ratios. Okay, debt ratios. Now the one that is, this is kind of a funny story, odd. Not ha-ha funny, but odd. Debt to total assets is, just as its name implies, total debt over total assets. Now, there are a couple of subtler ratios you can do here, too. I won't push them on you. You take a more advanced financial analysis class, and I'll talk to you about a few others in here. But this would be a percentage from 0 to 100. If the company has no debt, then it's obviously 0%. If the company is entirely leveraged, purely leveraged, then it'd be 100%. All companies are, we hope, between 0 and 100%. As the course goes on, you'll notice that it's in the second half of the course. You see that it's almost like the course turns toward that right there. We talk a lot, and there are several chapters and some math, some classic financial math, where we look at what's called optimal capital structure. Companies are quite interested in this, maintaining what they consider to be the right balance between debt and equity in the corporation. Companies will go to the extent that if their debt to total assets, or more importantly, their debt to equity ratio, goes too far outside of a certain range that they target, they'll actually, okay, suppose that the, I got to do this one. I'm getting ahead of myself here. The other way to put this is debt to equity, which would be total debt over shareholders' equity. Now, this one can swing between zero and infinity. Now, if you had 50-50, then the total debt to total equity would be 1. Debt to total assets would be 0.5, 50%. Okay? Many companies, especially big companies, if the ratio goes beyond a certain range, they will actually put it back into the range by deliberately selling the deficient, by deliberately increasing the amount of the deficient part. So, for example, if a company has a total debt to shareholder equity target of 1, in other words, half debt, half equity, and if they look through time and this ratio drifts away from 1, let's say it goes to 1.2, that would say their debt has increased compared to their equity. They would actually just sell equity, raise stock, raise money by selling stock just to get that back to the target. They would just do that. Or if, let's say, the total debt to shareholders' equity fell to 0.75 and their target is 1 on it, they would just borrow long-term to increase the debt part and therefore put the ratio back into balance. This is how interested companies are in optimal capital structure. The reason is that it turns out that the cost of debt falls as you get more debt, accumulate more debt, up to a point, and then the debt rises in cost to you. So the whole trick here is to find out where the perfect level of debt is, and that tells you where your perfect level of debt to total assets or debt to shareholders' equity is. I'm getting way ahead of myself saying that, though, so I'm going to back off and let it go. Okay. Now, here's one that's really big. The times interest earned. And again, obviously, this is a factor. EBIT, in other words, your operating income, divided by how much in interest you pay. And I'll just put interest expense here. It tells how many times over, one line above interest, you can pay your interest. So, for example, if my earnings before interest and taxes was $500,000 and my interest that I paid for the year was $50,000, my times interest earned would be 10, $500,000 divided by $50,000. That would say I can, with the money available to pay my interest payments, I can pay my interest 10 times over. Now, here's a rule. If that goes below 1, if times interest earned goes below 1, your ass is grass. You're default. You're in default. You don't have enough to pay your interest payments. The bondholders come in. They take over. Okay, so you obviously really care about keeping this above 1. But you might think, well, the higher, farther above 1, the better. The further above 1, the better. Not necessarily. Some companies, that's their policy. The farther we are from 1, the better. You'll see a company like that. But there's another side to the story. Remember how I told you that your weighted average cost of capital, I didn't say it that way, but your weighted average cost of capital actually falls for a while as you use more debt in your capital structure. So if you tell me proudly, well, my times interest earned is 25, I'll say you're using equity instead of debt, which you'd pay interest on, and equity is obscenely expensive compared to debt. You are not doing your shareholders any favor. You are financially mismanaging your firm by being that far away from 1 on the times interest earned. You could actually be you getting capital more cheaply if you use more debt in your total capital structure. So don't brag about how lean you are, how little your interest payments are. That gives me a hint that you're using expensive capital, stockholders' capital, which is very expensive compared to debt capital, for all to run this company. That's bad business. So no, times interest earned shouldn't be close to 1. That's scary. But just because it's on the other side of the galaxy from 1, that doesn't impress me either. You have to look at the whole picture. And you notice how I keep saying that. There's no magic numbers, and there are no guides that will tell you what's the perfect number. You have to think about what the number means here. Too low, the company is heading for default. It won't be able to pay its interest, and that's the end of the company. That is it, right there, game over. Too high, and they could use more debt in their capital structure. It was, just give you a quick view on this. I had a good friend, fairly good friends of mine. They were very proud of the fact that they had saved enough money. They're both making good money here in town, which if you get a good education here at ISU, you can make damn good money in this town if you know where to go and you know how to keep your nose clean. You don't end up on YouTube. But they're both making a lot of money, and they saved money, and they bought a really nice house. I mean, seriously nice. We're talking like $280,000 in one of the Tony neighborhoods not too far from here in Normal. And they said, we paid cash. And they were so proud of themselves. Now, neither of them has a business major. But it just, I wanted to say, you stupid assholes. But I did. You know, they were buying dinner, so you know, you don't do that. No, I shit you not. I kid you not. But I didn't dare say it to him. But I mean, it just floored me. Folks, take out a mortgage. The interest is deductible. It's a shield on your income. Are you on crack? Yeah, you got that money in the bank. Invest it in things, but don't invest it in the damn house. Borrow for the house. Because then, when you make your mortgage payments, you're going to be paying a buttload of interest on it, but that interest is deductible from your income you're earning in your jobs. So you're crazy the way you did it, because you're giving up all that you could earn with that money in big, powerful investments, and you're putting it in that nice little house on the prairie. Anyway, I didn't tell him that. It was a good dinner. Biagi's is a great place to eat. Okay, where the hell was I? Okay. We'll do the exercise part of this on Tuesday. I want to get through this part. And I'm trying to think how I want to configure this now, because I've got a couple here. Well, let me do the asset activity ratios first. The asset activity ratios. And I have to tell you, these are kind of like my least favorites, because these are more of the bean counter ratios. Just the inside story is like your inventory turnover. Inventory turnover tells me how many times over, this will be a times, how many times over did you flip your inventory during the year in terms of sales? So if my sales were 5 million and my inventory at the end of the year were, let's say, average inventory, we should really look at average here. Average inventory during the year was, let's say, $1 million. I can say that I turned my inventory over 5 times in sales during the year. Now, this is one of those ratios that is, again, too high or too low is not a great thing. If the inventory turnover ratio is too low, you probably got too much inventory for the sales that you're generating from it. If it's too high, that might tell me that you've gotten to one of those idiotic just-in-time inventory systems that the Japanese suckered us into. You might think, well, have you all heard of like just-in-time inventory systems? They are stupid ass. Don't do that. The Japanese did that to us to make us look like fools, I swear to God. You know why they're bad? Because if you are having to order everything as soon as when you need it, you're talking about transactions costs out the ass. Because every time, okay, well, we need, you're a grocery store. Someone's looking for a banana. Call Brazil. We need a banana. Yeah, right. Don't do that. And some of the companies like the auto manufacturers, oh, they went to just-in-time, and they forced all these companies to surround them that were their suppliers. When we need a car door, we're going to make our supplier be right here where I can deliver the car door. Well, when the auto company went tap city, guess what happened to all those companies that had no other place to go for their business because they had married themselves physically, locationally, to one car manufacturer? They went under two. Don't buy it. It's bull. And that's not an opinion. Yes, it is. Okay. Look, you're not going to get a whole lot of courses where you have this kind of opinion. It's good opinion. That's all I can say. Okay, now, average collection period. This is one that's actually, I probably wouldn't have you calculate, because you have to have the number for how much of your sales were credit sales to do this number. And this is accounts receivable over your average credit sales per day. So you would divide this number by 360. And that would give you your average collection period. Oh, geez. Okay, average collection period. Okay. Your average collection period, it's simply how long on average, how many days, and this number will come out in days, it takes you to get money on a credit, your actual cash money on a credit sale. Now, this is a balancing act, too, because if you're a company that says, we don't do credit sales, you're giving up an awful lot of yuppies that like to do credits, buy on credit. But on the other hand, of course, if you do all of your sales on credit, as I've pointed out before, you don't have any cash until someone pays you. So again, it's one of those. Is anyone bothered by the 360 there? Okay. Were you taught 360 in accounting? Was it ever mentioned to? Okay, I want to make sure.
365 or 360.
That's right. I just want to make sure because there is actually the transition going on here. Historically, and this, I've been teaching this since Jesus walked the earth. He was my student. I said, Jesus, use 360. You know what he said to me? Thou art weirdeth. You know why it's 360, right? You do. They taught you why it's 360. There's 360 business days in a year because there's five traditional holidays. Don't ask me which ones are the traditional because I can't remember. I think it's Christmas, New Year's, Thanksgiving, 4th of July.
Memorial Day.
No. No, wouldn't be Easter. That's on Sunday. Is it Labor Day or is it President's Day? I think it's President's Day.
Yeah, for President's.
That's right. That's right. That's why I can break into houses that day. Okay. So that's why we historically have used 360. But if we're later in the course, you'll see me say you use 360 in the denominator, but in the exponent you use 365. And that just makes people ask the burning question, duh-huh. Yeah, that's just the way we do it. That's just the way we do it. Live with it. If you don't like it, bite me. Okay, here we go. Okay, now there's one more. Your total asset turnover. Which is actually sales over total assets. Sales over total assets. In other words, how many times over did you turn your assets in terms of bucks you made? If you had sales of $20 million and your total assets are $10 million, then you, in a very real sense, your assets, your total assets, you actually used them two times over during the year. You got two times that much money off them. So that, so it's kind of a neat little number. It's kind of an interesting little number. And it'll show up in just a minute again. Now the last set of ratios, there's going to be a couple here that are not in the book. And there are going to be a couple here. There's one especially, but you'll notice when you read this chapter, you're going to see, well, wait a minute, he didn't talk about these here. You're right. One specifically, I won't talk about except to say that if you ever calculate it and I find out about it, I will hunt you down and I will give you a nuclear wedgie. I swear to God. Okay. The one that I don't want to ever see you try to calculate to use is the one that's called the market to book. Market to book. Don't ever use market to book. Book value of a company stock has no relationship to reality whatsoever. It is so far away from reality that it could be the former governor of Alaska. Biggie, price earnings ratio. Price of the stock, the market price of the stock of common stock divided by the earnings per share. Make sure that you use the market price per share, which is usually what you see, obviously. But make sure when you divide, you've done EPS and not total earnings. This is a times. It is effectively saying, based on the last reported earnings per share of the company, how many times over will a market investor pay? So if you told me that the price earnings ratio was 15, that tells me that for every dollar of earnings per share in the last reporting period, the market is right now paying $15 to claim those, to claim that. It's a very useful formula because historically, and in, when I first was learning and doing finance, we consider P-E ratios, and that's how we call them. We call them P-E ratios. Don't call it P-E, just say P-E ratio. We consider P-E ratios in the 7 to 15. Those were, you know, 4, 7, 15. Those were decent P-E ratios, good investments. And then in the 1990s, during the boom, for example, in the Japanese stock market, you saw P-E ratios 10,000, 80,000. What? They're paying $80,000 in cash money out of their pockets for every dollar the company earned last year. Are you on crack? What in the hell? But that was the way it was. Even to this day, you well, not to this day, but even in recent times, P-E ratios, what would have made me run around screaming like I'd been caught on fire, the analysts these days, oh yeah, that's a P-E ratio of 70. I'd nearly have a heart attack. But those are more normal, and they happen now. It's just, but know this, it's just, as that P-E ratio goes up, it's a risk. It's representing greater and greater risk. You're putting more money in now for every dollar that the current company earned last year. It's just that the P-E ratio is sort of like a quick rule of thumb way to look at the risk of a company. So if you've got a choice between two companies, one has a P-E ratio of, let's say, 10, and the other has a P-E ratio of 100, well, taking a lot of other things out of the equation, I can sort of roughly say that that one that has a P-E ratio of 100, that's a riskier investment than the one that has a P-E ratio of 10. But that's the way the market is these days, so that's how it goes. Now, the payout ratio, payout. That is the dividends, and it's dividends over net income. And this is total dividends over the net income. It's a percentage of your net income that the company pays out. Okay? Now, there's another one. This is one that's not in the book, and I was just checking there. I've got this little mark, not in book, in book. Okay, this next one is, you'll hear me use this term. That's why I'm bringing it up. It's called plowback, the plowback ratio. The plowback ratio is essentially just 1 minus the payout ratio. It's 1 minus the payout ratio. In other words, it's how much, okay, the payout ratio says the percentage of the company's net income that it gave to the shareholders. The plowback ratio is how much of the company's net income it kept for its operations. So these two sort of complement each other, but you'll hear me talk about plowback. I'll say, well, plowback. And what I'm saying is, look, the company can, it earns its net income. And then it will give some to the shareholders, the rest it will put back into the company. What we would call internally generated equity. That's literally what it is. It's the shareholders' money, but you're not giving it to the shareholders. It's equity, but the shareholders can't have it. They reach for it, you smack them on the hand like this. Okay. So my question always to a company is, yes, we understand that you have to give out a dividend. It's a signal. It makes the little blue-haired old ladies happy that they get a dividend check for their investment. We understand that. It's a signal. But if you are giving out lots of your money to your shareholders at the bottom line, that tells me, well, the question I ask is, why don't you have anything in here you can do with it instead to increase shareholders' wealth for the next period? You give your big, big dividends to make your shareholders happy so they don't bitch at you at the shareholders meeting. Well, that also tells me that you didn't have very good ideas about what to do with that money so that the shareholders have higher stock value, capital gains in the next period. Now, that's the next one that I'll do here is this right here. This is the dividend yield. This is a true market ratio, dividend yield. Dividend yield is the dividend per share divided by the market price per share. This is, in a large sense, from the investor's point of view, from the equity investor's point of view, essentially what you're making on your stock in the short run. So if I bought a stock for $20 and I get if my stock's price is $20 now, in other words, I could get rid of it for $20, keeping it represents an opportunity cost to me of $20. So $20 is my investment cost right now. Whatever the market price is my investment cost now, because I could get that money back if I sold it. So if the market price is $20 now, and I get a $1 check in the mail, that tells me that my investment that I have made by deciding to keep that stock and giving up $20 is 5%. It's sort of like a quick idea of how much you're earning in the short run. Now, ultimately, there will be the capital gains component as well. But in any given period, if you are keeping the stock, then that essentially is your investment, because if the stock price is $40 and you've got that stock in your hand, you are giving up $40 by keeping it. So whatever that dividend check is, that represents your yield on your investment for today, for the current period. Now, later you might sell and make a huge amount of money. The stock price might go up to $100 million. Dream on, Sparky. Dream on. Okay, now last thing I'm going to show you before I let you go here. The DuPont. Now, the book does a couple of DuPonts. Really, you can do DuPonts so big that trying to figure out what's what will turn you into a Presbyterian. So I'm going to just show you one of them. If I do net income over total assets, well, let me write it this way, and I'm going to have to watch my notes here to make sure that I don't screw up, because I could easily. Net income over sales. If I took net income divided by sales, and I timed that by sales divided by total assets, I could cancel sales top and bottom, and I would get net income over total assets. And you're saying to yourself, well, what the hell? But there's something kind of cool in here. It's actually useful. There are a couple of other DuPonts, but honest to God, this is the one that I've used that gave me the most bang for my buck in bothering to work on it. What's net income over total assets? Was that one of the ratios? What's net income over total assets? ROA. What's net income over sales? Net margin. What's sales over total assets? Total asset turnover. So, in other words, if I were to look at my return on assets, it's actually being driven by two animals. So if I saw my ROA going down the toilet or getting worrisome to me, I don't just have to say, oh, woe is me, return on assets sucks. I can look at this and say, which part of return on assets caused the problem? It gives me the ability to focus on the part of ROA that actually needs to be addressed. Instead of just willy-nilly attacking assets, I can say, oh, net margin was holding pretty good. It was my asset turnover that sucked. And that will tell me why ROA fell apart. Okay, on Tuesday, we'll do an exercise together here in class. That's all I have for you today. I thank you.